This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There are many experts in various fields in Northwest Indiana to talk to, and ranging from the universities and colleges in the region. Let's turn now to Valparaiso University. We're talking with Professor Anton Lewis. He is an associate accounting professor in the College of Business at VU. And Professor Lewis, thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you, Chris. It's an absolute pleasure to join you today.
One of the things I know that you focus in on in your courses that you teach on campus deal with diversity, equity, and inclusion in business. Will you tell us first about those courses that you teach, and how do they hopefully get across to the students in the classes, affect our economy here at home in Northwest Indiana and around the world?
Right then. Let me begin, Chris. I teach mainly financial accounting at an introductory level, managerial accounting at an introductory level, and also for accounting majors, audit and accounting information systems. And you might think to yourself, oh, what's that got to do with the life that I lead? Well, I often say to my students when we're talking about financial accounting that essentially it's about the language of money. And if you want to know how to be wealthy and rich, you've got to know a little bit about that. And that's usually how we begin some of our conversations about the importance of accounting. And, you know, further as well, when we get into conversations about managerial accounting, for example, we define that as the information that businesses need to gather for them to be able to make good decisions to make their businesses grow. When we look at audit, we look at, you know, can we rubber stamp the information that is being provided to people, to economic users, to shareholders? Can we make sure that that information that's being produced is error-free or is not fraudulent in some manner? And in accounting information systems, we cover the fact that everybody is now experiencing that we now live in a data-driven world, and that just as data is finding its way into the law with algorithms, just as data is finding its way into medicine with algorithms, it's finding its way into the realm of accounting. So we must be very aware of technological processes that are occurring. So as a bit of an overview, that's a very quick overview. Those are the subject topics that I tend to cover. Now, in the College of Business, we've currently got a push to highlight that in our world, we've got some issues that we all have to deal with, both regionally, nationally, and globally. Mm-hmm. We have issues concerning the environment. We have issues concerning social justice. On all these issues, we have issues concerning COVID-19, all things that we have experienced together globally and individually, if you like. And within our College of Business, we want to make sure that we are addressing within the courses that we teach some of the issues that people are experiencing every day. And so if I look particularly at the issue of social justice, how does that fit into accounting? Certainly in the book that I've written, and I'm sure we'll come on to more of that a bit later, I kind of highlight to the reader that my interest in social justice and accounting started many years ago back in the United Kingdom. And again, if your viewers are wondering, why does he have that odd accent? I'm actually from the United Kingdom. I'm a black British professor from the United Kingdom. And I found myself, after completing my accounting course and on my path to doing qualifications for accounting in the United Kingdom, I found that I'd work in several environments where I would be the only black person there. And it just occurred to me, I don't know why that is. Why is that the case? Accounting's a vital professional skill. Why don't we have more people of color around? And that started me on my path, and I was lucky enough to enroll on a doctoral program, and that was my base of knowledge. And that's how I began to explore this very area. Yeah. And so again, it behooves the question, why is this really an issue? Well, in Britain, I found, as I've already mentioned, that the representation of black British accountants was incredibly low. Now, I had the good fortune to meet my lovely American wife in this country, and so moved over. And I then altered my research to do a comparison against the black British accounting experience and the African-American accounting experience. And lo and behold, I found that it was very similar, that we have really low numbers. And to give you just a little bit of an idea, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, the AICPA, they're kind of the governing body of sorts of accountants here in the United States. Their 2019 data actually shows that black certified public accountants are about 2%. And when we compare that with, say, white accountants, they're 84%. And if we look at the higher realms of our accounting profession here in the United States, when we look at the partner level, just 1% of African Americans are partners. And that is compares rather against 91% that are white. So there's a real issue here. And the question becomes, why? Why does this issue occur? What is going on? Why is it that at this present time, the big four accounting company, Deloitte, has committed to putting $75 million worth of investment in diversity and inclusion in an attempt to redress some of this. And their particular path is for them to engage this program called MADE, Making Accounting Diverse and Equitable. Mm-hmm. And they're looking here to foster long-term change. And again, the initial view is that race, diversity, inclusion don't really matter as a core topic or issue within accounting. If that's the case, why has one of the world's largest accounting companies, Deloitte, committed to $75 million to try to change things? And that $75 million is part of what I believe to be over $1 billion commitment of U.S. Fortune 500 companies have made to also in generally engage in an increase in the representation of people of color and other stigmatized groups, looking to increase the presence of women, looking to increase the presence of those from working class backgrounds, looking to include more of our LGBTQ plus community within our workplaces. So this is very much a central core topic currently now of the accounting space.
Professor Lewis, would you say that what part of that you obviously learned from personal experience and from your professional experience before you even came to the United States in the UK was the fact that there were so few, number one, black accountants that were in business, had gone through school and gotten the qualifications to be able to work professionally in the UK in chartered accountancy? And then when you came over to the United States, it was no different. It was basically the same situation that you had encountered at home coming over to your new home, United States.
Well, yes, it was a bit of a shock. I had expected things to be better, but it wasn't. They were similar. You had similar kinds of things going on in two completely different spaces. The problem becomes why? Why is that? Why, when the Atlantic Ocean separates these two spaces, why is it that across the pond we've got the same sort of thing occurring, if you like, and, you know, we don't know why? And in my book, I actually do what I believe to be the first kind of comparison of the black British accounting experience and the African-American accounting experience, and kind of pose some theories as to why this may be the case.
Let's bring up the book now, if we can. You're the author of the book, which is called Counting Black and White Beans, Critical Race Theory in Accounting. It's going to be published by Emerald this fall. And when you got your notes together from personal experience and from other sources, I'm sure, to bring the book together, You mentioned in the title, of course, what is called critical race theory. Will you first explain for the average person that doesn't understand what CRT is, that you can call it, is all about, and how it pertains not only to real life, but also to business life?
Well, critical race theory is it's had a lot of really bad press at the moment in the US and beyond, in the United Kingdom and across Europe. A lot of people kind of rail against it without truly knowing what it is. And critical race theory basically poses one particular way of viewing the world. It says, let's be realistic about race and racism, and that we all live racialized lives, and that actually for people of color, race is quite a central feature of our lives. And that's basically it. It says, let's look at things from a racialized perspective that is not at the periphery. Let's just admit that much of the life of people of color, including people who are white, are racialized. And this is what we might pertain to a notion or an idea of racial realism. And that's essentially it. And to give you a very brief history of it, critical race theory really came out of a group of critical legal scholars who, the end of the 1980s, just in 1989, right about 1990s, found themselves having conversations about why the law was not as focused on issues of race and racism, and that this idea that the law was completely meritocratic and completely fair, well, they challenged that idea and said, actually, when it comes to people of color, particularly African Americans within the United States, the law isn't particularly free from bias. And then they went on to begin to explore what that might mean, using other race-critical scholars, such as Derek Bell as another example of who were already in the mid-80s and early 80s doing this kind of analysis. And we find that critical race theory then spreads across to education, where educationalists around the country, academics involved in education, began asking, well, you know, we believe that race is a central feature of aspects of education. Well, how does that apply? You then find it in other more esoteric areas like sports. How can we look at centralizing race in sports? And as you can imagine there, I come along and simply pose the very straightforward question of, well, you know, can we centralize a view of race in accounting? What would that mean if we were to do so? And that's a very brief kind of look. And I should just also add at the end of that, one of the dangers is to believe that critical race theory just looks purely in a very narrow focus only at race. And that isn't quite true. There's a very important canon, as we would call it, with critical race theory that introduces the concept of intersectionality. And intersectionality basically says that if we were to find a solution to the race problem, in inverted commas, if that was ever at all possible, then it wouldn't work unless we were also able to find a solution for why women experience sexism in the workplace, why there are gendered inequalities that exist in our society and our workplaces. And when we deal with that particular issue, it's still not going to be particularly well solved, because gender and race intersects, but also class intersects as another inequity. And we would also have to deal with class. So we would actually have to deal with a range of inequalities for us to be able to have the socially just environment I believe that we all actually want. So really, critical race theory is just one lens at looking at getting to the core feature, if you like, of living in a better world. I hope that gives you a bit of an overview, and I hope I've explained that to you in a reasonable way.
We appreciate taking time on that, because I know this is going to be a subject I hope that we can talk about again and again in the future when we do get back together again. But let me ask one last question for now. What do you feel is the greatest threat to a diverse culture in the workplace, since we're focusing not only globally about the issue of racial theory, but also about the workplace. And you mentioned in particular because of the effect that on accountancy in particular.
Yes, to answer your question, Chris, and I'll do it straight away, it's talk. It's what we're doing now. We have managed to enter into a place where it is incredibly difficult for us to talk about certain topics, of which race is one, without taking a stance that is polarized. If we can't talk about the issue of race, and I've already stated that I believe, and many other critical race theorists believe, it's so central, then we can't rectify this problem. This is an issue that we only have a chance of beginning to reduce if we work together. We can't work together if we can't speak to each other. And that's one of the reasons that I myself have engaged in this Counting Black and White Beans podcast. I'm busy getting together a blog. I'm busy looking and being very grateful to be able to talk to you about this as a way of reaching out toward everybody, no matter one's hue, to say, look, we need to be able to talk about this and actually suffer oppositional viewpoints without devaluing the person saying it. So you can have an oppositional view to what I believe in only through having oppositional views. Working together to get through those views, can we find a better way, essentially, together? That is the barrier I think we're trying to beat, if you like. Mm-hmm. The fact that whether it's in the accounting space or whether it's in the generalized workplace or whether it's in our society, we don't do race talk, and we don't talk about a myriad of other inequities such as gender, such as class, etc., to name but a few, without taking very polarized positions which actually stop the conversation. That's my feeling about this, and that's what I believe we've got to attack.
Professor Anton Lewis is an associate professor of accounting at Valparaiso University within the School of Business at VU. Professor Lewis, thank you for taking time for our initial conversation today on this. And as I said, we'll circle back around and bring up many of these topics again in future conversations. Thanks for being with us today.
Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your rather excellent show.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Chris Chung has made the transition from being a state lawmaker here from Northwest Indiana's delegation to maybe close to the White House, or at least down the street, not literally, but Washington, D.C., to be sure. He has made the transition from being a member of Indiana's legislature to joining a think tank based in Washington, D.C., and he is with us for a little while to talk about his new job and, in particular, the role that the think tank that he is working with now has to do with Indiana politics. And, Chris, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Well, first, if you will, tell us a little bit about the Center for American Progress, which is the think tank that you are now working for.
Absolutely. So CAP is based in Washington, D.C., and right now I'm the campaign manager for our state to federal climate initiative. And basically, Chris, what we're doing here is showing how a lot of states have passed really bold legislation that helps unions and helps disadvantaged communities and helps the green economy flourish in various parts of the country. And we're really elevating those to federal policymakers as well as the administration and White House as examples of things that they can do to jumpstart their economies, to diversify their economies, to create hundreds of thousands of jobs, and to make smart investments that clean our air and water for everybody. So I'm really excited about the potential for the job and also how it impacts Northwest Indiana.
That's good to hear. I'd like to get more information about what you're doing and more about this State House to White House initiative that you're working on. But first, tell us, how did you learn about this position after finishing up your term of office as Indiana representative?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, Chris. Actually, it was after the Georgia Senate runoff elections in January earlier this year that solidified one-party control on a very, very narrow margin in Washington, D.C. And that made me think, you know, well, there's options for public policy and really great policymaking in the federal level that I, you know, if there's anything I could do to be a part of that, that would be great. I feel like I've learned so much in the state of Indiana working with Republicans, Democrats, independents, and people across the entire political spectrum have taught me so much. And maybe there's a lesson that Hoosiers can give Washington, D.C. So I really looked online and made some calls, and it became a great fit. So I've been here since May.
That's great. What did you find in working there, of course, out the State House, that you're able to put together in particular with what you're focusing on right now? And I know that you mentioned before we talked that you're also spending time not only on looking at state climate policy and working with campaigns around the country, but you're also spending time taking a look at this reconciliation bill that is currently working its way through Congress. Or maybe right now it's not working for its way through Congress, but it should be at least.
That's right. It's a big part of the president's agenda to get this spending package. And there's a lot of variegated stuff in there. There's a child tax credit. There's an expansion of Medicare to cover hearing, dental, and vision. There's taxing the wealthy in order to fund it and corporations. And there's also a big climate piece to make sure that we're decarbonizing the electricity grid, diversifying our sources of energy, and not just relying on coal-fired power plants to power our electricity, but looking at solar and wind, which is getting cheaper and more efficient every day. So there's a whole lot of lessons there I felt that could be taken from the Northwest Indiana economy and kind of laid on as an analogy to what we're working on in Washington, D.C. I mean, we see what happens when cities in North Lake County put all their eggs into one industry basket without diversifying their economies. And that's why, in my view, we need comprehensive, fully funded renewable power laws that can make our electricity grid future-proof. If we continue to put all of our eggs in the fossil fuel basket and continue to give out hundreds of billions of dollars in tax incentives to polluting industries, we risk being left behind by every other economy, and we risk a lot of jobs being lost in the future. So it's time for us to make a really smart step to prepare, and that's what I'm hoping to do.
We are finding lately here that some of the utilities, NIPSCO in particular, is branching out there, getting involved in solar energy and eventually, and I'm sure, in wind energy. They've already decided to set up a number of locations around the state that in turn will produce the electricity that will come back to Indiana, Northwest Indiana in particular. And we're also learning, too, that there's another major project just to the east of us over in Stark County, where a huge solar energy farm is going to be created over there. Are these more projects that should be invested in, certainly, and created to help deal with some of the issues, get ourselves out of the economy that's full of carbon, so to speak?
That's exactly right, Chris, actually. And even those projects directly benefit from federal legislation. Right now, we have clean energy tax credits that are on the books in the tax code. However, they've been stopped and restarted, I think it's more than a dozen times over the last 20 years. So there's a lot of variability, administration to administration, Congress to Congress, every 2 years on whether these continue. And it's created a lot of instability in the industry, whether you're developing a solar farm, whether you're building wind turbines and installing them. There needs to be more certainty in the industry to help projects like that look at the long term, not just the short term, and flourish over the next several years and decades beyond that. So clean energy tax incentives, Chris, are actually a big part. I think it's up to around $150 billion plus in the reconciliation bill out of the top line of $3.5 trillion, which is probably going to come down a little bit. But also the other component to clean energy tax incentives is the clean electricity standard, which basically says that whenever you're plugging in your iPhone to charge it up, or if you get an electric car, that you won't be polluting the environment because all the electricity will be clean. When we transition from coal-fired power plants into wind, into hydropower, into solar, and putting that on a sensible on-ramp, of course, it's not going to be like flipping a switch overnight and then we see all these solar farms across the farms in Indiana. It's going to be more of a graduated program over the next several years. And we're hoping that we can see something like that because the studies show it benefits unions, it benefits our economies, and it benefits all of us with less pollution.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana native Chris Chung, who has made the transition from being a former state representative in the State House to working now as the campaign manager for an initiative called State House to White House. It's based at the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank that is based in Washington, D.C. And Chris, you have the opportunity to take a look at climate policy from a lot of states around the country. And are there any in particular that you've found interesting that you think that if it's the right conditions with the right kind of funding, that Indiana might be able to adapt?
Absolutely, there are. In fact, it just happening in, I think it was Oregon, was one of the most recent states that put in a plan to have 100% clean electricity by 2040. So like I said, they're going to be able to have a graduated system, not a dramatic change overnight, where they make sure that they take care of the jobs and the unions that could potentially be affected by the transition, making sure that wind turbines and solar panels are not only installed, but manufactured in the U.S. too. I mean, the administration has taken a bold step to censure and stop the import of solar panels from Xinjiang, China, because of the allegations of use of forced labor in the manufacture of those. And that's something that not only benefits the folks who care about human rights, but also benefits our domestic manufacturing. I mean, you can look back at history, Chris, and Republican and Democratic administrations alike have kind of frankly abandoned domestic manufacturing in favor of outsourcing jobs because that's cheaper for the big multinational corporations. It's better for the bottom line for corporate profits. And we just can't let them make the same mistakes of the past, which is why we got to make it in America. Even though there's a little more short-term hardship to setting up those plants and to training the workforce, if we put in a lot of dollars now to make sure that Hoosiers are building those solar panels and wind turbines, and other states are as well, then we can ensure that we'll be ready for the future and won't have to rely on a foreign national.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up a topic that, is, at least as far as a project in the West Coast is concerned, in Oregon. Are there any here in the Midwest that are being looked at closely and perhaps being made some adaptations that could possibly work here in the Hoosier State?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just next door in Illinois, they've passed a plan for clean power. I think they're going to shoot for 100% by 2045 in a similar fashion, and they're looking at disadvantaged communities that have been screwed over because the power plant, you know, builds something right next to their house and it pollutes a lot of the poorer communities, whether you're rural or communities of color. And also in Minnesota, I believe, I think they were the first state in the Midwest to pass clean cars legislation, which basically says that by a certain point in time, several years from now, or I think more than a decade out, auto dealerships will be required to provide electric vehicles to a certain degree and charging incentives as well. To make sure that the adoption of that is stepped in and not just like trying to change the entire auto economy overnight. So it's a sensible policy. It's the first in the Midwest policy. And yeah, Minnesota and Illinois are some of the ones that have been leading in the Midwest. But it's happening all over the country too, Chris. I mean, there are cities that are doing it on their own. And there are states on the coast, as you can imagine, who are taking a bit more of a bolder lead. But here in the Midwest, I think there's so much potential, especially in Indiana.
Do you believe that the new position that you're in right now with the Center for American Progress is going to give you an opportunity to work a little closer with Hoosier policymakers? You're certainly working on ways to broaden that state climate policy around the country and working with your colleagues looking closer to Indiana.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, right now we've really put our focus across the country, not just because I'm from Indiana. As much as I'd love to just pay attention to Indiana, there's so much happening in the other 49 states that we've got to spread our attention elsewhere. But absolutely, I think there's so much that Hoosiers can get to a place of understanding where whether you're Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. I mean, everybody likes clean energy jobs. Everybody likes spurring the economy. It's just a matter of how fast do we do it? How much do we pay for it? And those are the hangups. It's not a matter of if it needs to be done or not. Everybody, I think, kind of agrees to some degree that it needs to happen. It's just a matter of the speed, the funding, and toning down the ridiculous rhetoric that can sometimes come out of D.C. and bringing that Hoosier sensibility to some of those conversations.
Mm-hmm. I know you're working with your colleagues there at the think tank. Are you in turn working, with whatever lobbyists within the organization that do actually meet with members of Congress? Are they getting to work trying to get heads turned, get some things done about this reconciliation bill that you've been spending time analyzing?
Yeah. So the Center for American Progress has lobbyists and a sister organization. I'm on the C3, the nonprofit, nonpartisan side, where we're mainly strictly doing policy analysis and not really talking to elected officials or trying to get their votes on anything. But the research we put out, I mean, obviously influences what the debate is about and what kinds of influences and statistics we see on the economy when you're talking about clean power. So I'm not a lobbyist. I never really liked lobbyists, to be yeah. quite honest, but certainly the policy analysis, the communication side that I'm on is definitely something that we think is a net positive for people. If they just get to some place of understanding, I think we could all use a little bit more understanding in this country and in governing, and it'll help us in the long run.
Well, I would imagine that the lobbyists that work there at the Center for American Progress need to have some ammunition that they can take back and push towards getting something done on Capitol Hill. And so at least your work is able to give them the kind of information they need to try to persuade lawmakers to make the right decisions.
Well, we hope so. I mean, sometimes, you know, the research doesn't always turn out as great as we think, but that's even just another point, another data point that shows us, you know, maybe this isn't, we thought this was the right policy. Maybe in the long term it's not. And there's another thing we can do to pass a better policy for unions and for green energy advocates and for rural economies. All of that stuff goes into the research that we're doing, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, Chris, thank you for spending time with us talking about your position there as the campaign manager with the State House to White House initiative, dealing with, in this case, looking at state climate policy and campaigns to decarbonize the economy through the Center for American Progress. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again, and maybe you'll have some good news as well next time we do. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. You have a good one.
You too. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.